By the time I've prepared Eddie's gear, it's 6 a.m. and the house is still silent. I pour myself a cup of coffee and wander into the living room, where I turn the television on to a news channel and then promptly zone out into the background noise. I look around the room, the endless books on the shelves and the dust on the windowsill I probably should address at some point. This is my favorite room, and this house feels more like home to me than any other house I've ever lived in. We bought this place 6 years ago when Wade got the first in a series of promotions. It's not that we're extravagantly wealthy, but he earns well above an average salary these days, and I can't really get my head around how his bonus scheme works, but it seems to bring in a lot of money. Something about performance indicators for the team he manages, and every few months he has a win at work. Then there's another large deposit into the account, and Wade wants to drink champagne, and I listen to him as he tries to explain it. I nod and smile, but I never really grasp it because I just don't have a frame of reference for his world. I've never had a job with performance indicators. The last job I had was tutoring freshman English majors at college. Even then, I just did it because everyone else I knew had a job, and I mostly spent the money on eating out or clothes. Mom and Dad were borderline obsessed with my education, and I guess that makes sense, with Mom's career being the most important part of her life and Dad himself being an academic at the time. They were more than happy to support me financially throughout my college years. I had a much easier time relying on my parents for money than I do my husband. I'm a confused mix of grateful, guilty, and frustrated about the circumstances of my family every single day. But for our decision to have a family young, and our decision that I should stay home long term once we realized that Eddie was not going to be your run-of-the-mill kid, I'd have a career too, and things would be different. But things aren't different, and they have never seemed equal. It's not anything Wade does or says that makes me feel that way. Sometimes I wonder if I'd feel this uncomfortable about our situation if I'd set out to be a stay-at-home mom. Instead, that life just kind of happened to me, and now there are some days when this beautiful home is a little like a gilded cage.
Mommy?
I startle and look up to find Callie is standing in the doorway. She is pale this morning, her honey blonde hair a bedraggled mess around her shoulders, her big blue eyes swimming with tears.
Honey Bear, I gasp, falling back automatically into the nickname Wade and I gave her as a baby.
What is it? I push the coffee cup onto the table and open my arms to her. She runs across the room and launches herself at me.
I'm sorry, I called Eddie a retard.
Oh, Callie, I know you are. Yesterday was a bad day all round, wasn't it?
But maybe you don't know the origin of that word, Mommy. It is a terrible word. It once was a legitimate medical term, but it's been used to denigrate disabled people for decades now. I looked it up on etymologyonline.com. I committed a hate crime against my baby brother, and he doesn't even know it, which makes it even worse, because only you and me and Daddy know what a terrible person I am. How can you ever forgive me?
I tuck her in closer to me and hide a smile as I run my hand over her hair. You're not perfect, Callie Michaels. You're allowed to make mistakes.
A hate crime is a little more than a mistake, she says, and she's full on sobbing now.
Now that you understand why I got so angry with you about that word, will you ever use it again?
Are you kidding me?
She gasps, pulling away from me to stare at me in horror. Her face is awash with tears, and I wonder how much sleep she's had. A pang of guilt hits me because I didn't even check that she went to sleep last night. That's what happens in our house sometimes. My default position is checking on Eddie. Callie has learned to fend for herself, but it's not okay.
Of course I won't use that word again. I couldn't bear it now that I know what it means.
Well, that's all that matters. Say sorry to Eddie later and let's drop it.
But it's unforgivable.
Baby, you're overthinking this now, I say softly, and she pauses.
Oh,
she says, and then she gives a miserable little sniff.
Okay.
Watch a train video with Eddie tonight to make it up to him. All will be forgiven.
Okay, Mommy.
I cuddle her close again and rest my head against hers. I'm sorry you were frustrated at school yesterday, Callie.
I'm sorry I acted like a spoiled brat about it, Mommy.
I forget sometimes that she has challenges too. I forget that the world is just as mystifying for Callie, who sees too much of it, as for Eddie, who understands so little. Just as Eddie needs me to make a way in this world for him, Callie needs me to help her navigate her own way. Should we wake the boys up and get this day started? I ask her.
Can we wait 5 more minutes?
She whispers, and she snuggles closer into me.
I like it sometimes when it's just you and me.
Me too, honey bear, I whisper back. Me too. I'm at the hospital by 9 a.m., right on schedule today. Babcia is dozing lightly when I step into her room, so I take a seat quietly beside her bed. The iPad is within her reach, sitting on the tray table. Right behind it is a collection of what I suspect are the most precious things in my grandmother's world. On the very top of the pile, there's a handmade leather shoe, the size a very new baby might wear. The shoe is clearly very old and not particularly well made. The stitching is coarse and uneven, and it's made up of several shades of aged leather. I wonder if it belonged to my mother, and why Babcia kept it. Why she's showing it to me now. Beneath the shoe, there are 2 letters. The top one is in a fairly modern envelope with my name on it in Babcia's careful handwriting. The envelope has faded a little, so I know it's not new, but even without that clue, I'd have been sure she wrote it almost a decade ago, because the address on the front is in Connecticut. She must have written this letter when I was still at college, because a few months after I graduated, Wade and I decided to move back here to Florida. Just then, she opens her eyes and raises her left hand to my wrist. We share a smile. Then she nods toward the letter, so I tear it open and unfold the paper inside.
Dearest Alice, how are you, my beautiful granddaughter? I hope you are enjoying your last semester at college. I am so very proud of you for earning your degree. Did you know your mother was the first person ever in my family to do so? I am so happy that we are here in America, where you have so many opportunities. Darling, I need a favor. It is an immense one, and I hesitate to ask it. But I feel that time might be running out, and I am becoming desperate. With Pa's illness, I am going to be needed here more and more, so this might be my last chance to get away. There are ends left untied for my life in Poland, things left unspoken, and more importantly, questions left unanswered. I am sure that you know by now I find it so difficult to speak about the war and our life back home, but there are things I simply must know before I can finish out my days in peace. But I am 85 years old now, darling Alice, and it has been 65 odd years since I left Poland in such a hurry. I am sure it is a whole new world to the life I once knew. I would like to invite you to join me for a brief holiday there. I will pay your way. I simply need help to plan the trip and then someone to accompany me. You are so smart, my darling, and so clever at finding things out from all of your studies and your writing. Perhaps you could think of this as a graduate project on your own family history. I asked Julita a while ago, and thought for some time that she might join me, but she is so busy with her new job now, and besides, now I will need her to look after Pa if I am to go away. If you can spare me the time, perhaps we could take 2 weeks to visit the home of my ancestors, and to try to find some information for me. It would mean the world, Alice, truly. We could go as soon as you graduate, and perhaps we could take a trip to Paris or Rome so you can see some more of Europe as an expression of my gratitude to you. Love always. Babcia.
I'm cast immediately back into the timing of this letter, the most tumultuous time of my life. Pa had just been diagnosed with dementia, just a few weeks after Mom was appointed to the district court. Dad was still working as an economics professor at the University of Florida, but talking about retiring so he could travel, without Mom, given he'd finally accepted she was serious when she said she was hoping to work until her brain or body gave out. Wade was finishing his 2nd graduate degree and working in his 1st full-time job. And then when my final results came in, there was a marked decline in my academic performance in the final semester of my degree, because I was spending most of my waking hours obsessing about how to tell my family that instead of taking an internship the following school year, I'd be becoming a mom. I look up from the letter now, and my vision is blurred as I drag myself back to the here and now. Babcia is looking at me expectantly, and I feel a crushing sense of grief for the missed opportunity. If she'd sent the letter, I'd have gone with her anyway, pregnant or not. Even so, I'm not surprised that she didn't ask once she knew I was about to become a mom. Babcia has always respected the singular focus I want to have for my family. Now, Babcia awkwardly picks up the other letter with her left hand, and she drops it near to me on the tray table. I open it very carefully. This is clearly much older than the first letter. Even unfolding the rough, aged paper, I fear it's going to fall to pieces. It feels like something I should handle while wearing cotton gloves while standing in a museum. Most of the ink has faded, and only the bottom few lines of the letter are still vivid. It's in Polish, although it's so light I'm not sure even someone who did read the language could make much sense of it. I can barely make out the first few lines, but I can see the name at the bottom. Thomas. I look at her blankly, but she's silently crying now, and she reaches across to very gently take the older letter from my hands. She folds it again, then rests it on the tray table. Tears flow freely down her cheeks, but she wipes her face with the back of her hands and reaches with some determination for the iPad. She has all of the icons she needs saved into her favorite screen, so it takes only a moment for her to start our conversation.
Alice, find Thomas. Alice, Plain, Poland. Alice, Plain, Trebinia. Babcia, fire, Thomas.
She looks at me expectantly, then hits the Your Turn button. My heart sinks all over again as I take the iPad. My hands tremble a little as I peck out my response.
Babcia, no plane.
She impatiently snatches the iPad from me.
Yes,
she types, and I think we're in an awkward argument until she spends the next several minutes correcting me as she accesses the icons from the recently used screen.
Babcia, sick. Babcia, old. Babcia, no plane. Alice, plane. Alice, plane, Trebinia. Find Thomas. Babcia, fire Thomas.
But I can't go to Poland, Babcia, I protest aloud, forgetting for a moment that it's pointless to do so. She hits the repeat button on the iPad, then looks at me. And when I simply stare at her as I try to figure out how to explain to her how insane this is, she presses repeat again. And then again. Then she puts the iPad down, crosses her arms over her chest, and stares at me stubbornly. Her chin is raised. Her jaw is set. Babcia looks exactly like my daughter did last night when I walked through my front door. But, I protest weakly, I couldn't leave Callie, and I couldn't leave Wade. And I definitely couldn't leave Eddie. I can't even begin to imagine how I could make that work. Wade would never take time off. Eddie would never adjust to my absence. Callie would act up too. God, it would be a nightmare for all of them. Besides, I'm still not sure what question Babcia wants me to answer. Who are these people? What the hell is Babcia Fire Thomas supposed to mean? Say I flew all the way across the world for her, what would I even do when I got there? Babcia can either read my mind, or she's thinking the same thing. She swipes back to the home screen on the iPad and finds the FaceTime button. Then she points to the icon and then looks at me again. When I look at her blankly, she swipes over to the camera button, then she jabs at it and she opens the photo roll. It's empty because this is Mom's iPad and she's not really the grandma paparazzi sort, but I get the message anyway. My grandmother wants to see her homeland one last time. Babcia passes me the iPad now, and I open the AAC and swipe vaguely through the icons, wondering how I'm supposed to use this limited language to say, there's no way in hell I can arrange to fly to Poland and take some photos for you, especially not on short notice, and we have no idea how long you have left, so I'd have to go straight away anyway. How do I tell the woman who offered me endless love and acceptance for my entire life that the first favor she's ever asked of me is one I have to decline? How do I tell a person who's given me everything that the one thing she wants from me is too much? The answer comes swiftly. I can't. When the family matriarch tells you to do something, you damn well do it. But she's asking something of me that I'm not even sure I can physically arrange in the timeline we have. But there is no icon for maybe on the AAC. The concept is too vague for children like Eddie, and that's who the program was designed for. Instead, I swipe to the notes screen to type the word maybe, but I'm startled to find there are already notes there.
Trebinja. Ulica Sveltojanska, 4. Trebinja. Ulica Polarechka, 9B. Trebinja. Ulica Vorchuk, 38. Trebinja. Alina Ziak. Emilia Slaska. Mateusz and Truda Rabinek. Saul Eva Tikva Weiss. Prosha Zrozum. Thomas. I look up at her, confused. Those notes are in Polish, which she knows all too well that I don't understand. I lift the iPad so she can't see the screen, then swipe to Google, load Google Translate, and type in the words, "Can you understand me?" I hit the speaker icon, and words that mean nothing to me fill the air. But Babcia's eyes widen, and she nods enthusiastically. We share a grin, and then I flick back to the notes section on the iPad, and my heart sinks again. I can feel my grandmother's eyes on me, sharp and questioning and desperate and hopeful. I swallow hard, then I raise my gaze to her. We stare at each other in the silence until she nods, just once, and then she seems satisfied. She sinks back into her pillows and closes her eyes again, the echo of a smile lingering on her lips. I have no idea what she thought she saw on my face just now, but I spend the rest of the day at her bedside, trying to figure out if there's a way to make this work.
Chapter 13. Alina. Tomas and I immediately fell into a pattern of nightly visits where we'd share a few innocent kisses and an awkward cuddle through the window frame. But it was impossible for us to speak much because my parents were always asleep on just the other side of the wall. I had a million or more questions I needed to ask him. So many things I wanted to tell him or to hear him say. But it all had to tumble out in fragments of conversation because he never dared to stay more than a few minutes at a time.
"Let me come to the woods," I would plead with him. "It is too hard for us to talk here the way we need to."
"I don't think that's a good idea, Alina," he would whisper back. "If your parents catch you leaving the house, it will be impossible for you to explain."
"But if they catch us talking here?"
"If they catch us talking here, I promise you I will disappear so fast you will think I've turned invisible."
There was the cocky boy I'd fallen in love with, arrogant in the confidence he had that he could protect me. He seemed to think he had transferred the risk of our meeting from me to himself by coming to the house. But I wasn't so sure. The problem was that it was impossible to argue with him, not least in part because we had to talk in whispers. I wanted explanations, but my desperation to meet him in the woods ran even deeper than that. I wanted to hold him and kiss him and to talk with him openly. I quite desperately missed Tomas's stories. I missed the fairy tales and the exaggerations, and even the possibly outlandish facts about far-flung lands and biology and science. But there was no time for extended conversations like that when we were whispering through my window. Those visits each night were a fleeting luxury, one that felt increasingly too short. But I didn't dare feel disappointed, because at least he was back. And I was well aware how lucky I was to have even that. It was only a few days after Tomas's return that Mama and I walked to tend the field near the Goleshevsky property and found Jan on his hands and knees, weeding. I was walking in front and soon found I was near enough that I felt it only polite to greet him. "Hello, Jan," I said, as politely as I could manage. "How are you today?" Jan's bushy gray eyebrows dipped low, and his forehead creased as he peered up at me.
"Ola has taken Justyna away. I thought you would like to know."
"Jan," Mama greeted him abruptly as she approached.
"Faustina,"
Jan said, his tone just as short.
"Where has Justyna gone?" I asked hesitantly.
To the city?
Yes, to the city, Jan confirmed. But his face was reddening and his nostrils had flared, and I knew that he was not pleased with this turn of events.
In any case, she is gone, and that is that.
He nodded curtly once more at Mama, then he dumped his tools into the dirt and turned and walked away across the field to their home. Jan had always seemed so imposing to me, but that day he seemed smaller somehow. Perhaps because it was evident to me that for all of his bluster and energy, he was actually just a man, and now a very lonely one at that.
I am sorry your friend is gone, Alina, Mama murmured as we returned to our own home.
Thank you, Mama. I so rarely saw Justyna, I knew I'd barely miss her. Still, I was a little sad, but perhaps not nearly as sad as I would have been had it happened a few weeks earlier. On nights when the moon was full and I could really see Tomas well, there was no mistaking that the hollows of his cheeks grew with every passing day. I decided I would find a way to get him some food. I was aware that I would be stealing food from my mother, who was likely stealing food from the Nazis, but I was far more terrified of Mama than I was of the invaders, and that was saying something. The first time I passed Tomas a cup of scraps from my dinner, the flare of sheer hunger in his gaze was worth the terror I'd felt squirreling the food away.
How did you get these?
From my dinner, I said. He hesitated, and I waved toward the food. Please, Tomas, go ahead. I had plenty.
He laughed incredulously.
Helena Ziak, there has not been plenty in this country since the occupation began. Don't lie to me, your skin and bones.
Please, eat it. I get two or even three meals a day most of the time. It's not luxurious, but I'm surviving. But you?
I wasn't sure how to draw attention to his rapidly fading physique without being cruel. So after a pause, I simply took his hand in mine and whispered,
Tomas, I'm scared for you. You can't keep going like this. I don't know what you're doing, and you clearly don't want to tell me. But surely it involves a lot of sneaking around, and a lot of trying to keep your wits about you. Let me at least give you the scraps from the scraps they give us.
He picked up a chunk of bread and sniffed it, almost suspiciously. Then he tossed it into his mouth and his eyes widened.
I am fairly sure the Nazis aren't giving you strawberry jam with your bread, he said cautiously, and I shrugged.
You aren't the only person in this district undertaking covert activities. Mama seems to have a mysterious hidden store somewhere.
I'll do you a deal, darling Alina,
Tomas said thoughtfully as he took some potato from the cup.
If you can spare me some food, I'll eat half of it and pass the rest on to my friends. Is that okay?
But there's barely any food here, even for you, I whispered desperately. Please, can you just eat this, and tomorrow I'll try to get more food for your friends.
Well, if there's a way for you to do that without endangering your sneaky mama or yourself, then...
My bedroom door flew open just then, and Father was there in my doorway, bleary-eyed and frowning.
Alina, he said flatly, who on earth are you talking to?
I looked frantically to the window, but Tomas was gone. Instead, I looked up to the sky, and as I started to desperately pray for a convincing lie, I realized I already had one.
I was praying, I said.
Praying, my father repeated without any attempt to hide his suspicion.
Yes, praying for Tomas.
Father frowned a little harder.
Go to sleep, he said. We have a lot of work to do tomorrow.
He took a step back toward the open area, then hesitated.
Leave the door open.
I climbed quickly into bed, my heart racing, my gaze on the window. Tomas didn't come back, but in the morning, the empty cup had been nestled back through the window and tucked into my bedding. The night after my father caught us talking, Tomas came to the window as he had been doing, but he was wearing a heavy frown. I knew before he spoke that he was coming to say goodbye.
I'm so sorry, he whispered. It was risky. We knew it was risky.
No, I'm sorry, I whispered back. I was careless. I was too loud. I promise I'll be more careful.
He sighed, then pinched the bridge of his nose. Anxiety was radiating off him, and when I reached through the window to rest my hand against his shoulder, I felt his tension in my own body. Tomas leaned toward me and kissed my cheek.
Alina, this isn't smart anymore, he whispered miserably. We can't keep doing this.
I bit my lip.
But how else can I see you? Perhaps we could just tell Mama and Father.
No, he interrupted me, his voice a desperate whisper. No, they can't know, Alina. They can't. It's bad enough that you know I'm here. This isn't safe. You know that, don't you?
How can I know that? I don't even understand what you did.
He sighed and shot me a pleading look.
If we tell your parents, I don't think they'll allow us to see each other anymore.
Of course they will.
Alina,
he said very gently.
Please, trust me, moje wszystko. Your parents love you, and they will want to keep you safe. And there is nothing safe about you meeting with me.
But
even if I am wrong, and they are supportive of us still seeing each other, it is just too risky to let anyone else in on our secret. If anyone finds out I'm visiting with you.
He raised his chin, then looked right into my eyes.
I don't care what happens to me. I really don't. But if anything happens to you because of me, I couldn't.
He trailed off then, his eyes on my bedroom door. I'll find a way to come see you during the day. Would that be better, if I met you in the woods instead?
In the daylight?
He said this as if the suggestion was absurd, but I shrugged. Perhaps before the war people walked on that hill sometimes, but now you are the only person I've seen there in years, other than Truda and Mateusz and your sister when they visit for Sunday lunch. It is as safe a meeting place as we are ever going to find. He still stared at me skeptically, so I gave him a pointed look.
You've been there for weeks and not been noticed, Tomas. Has anyone even come close to finding you? Who exactly do you think is going to catch us there together?
Your parents would surely notice if you came to the woods every day.
I know. I would ask them permission to visit the woods, but not tell them why I wanted to.
He sighed heavily.
What possible reason could you have to come to the woods every day, Alina?
You're not the only one in this relationship who can be resourceful, I whispered, but I forced a teasing, light-hearted tone into my voice,
and he gave me a reluctant laugh.
Okay, Alina Dziak. Let's see what you can do.
At breakfast, I delivered the speech I'd sat up half the night preparing.
Mama, I said, I have decided that I will undertake a spiritual commitment to pray the rosary for our country each day. I'm going to get up earlier in the morning and spend an hour alone in prayer at the hill.
Mama set her coffee down on the table and raised an eyebrow at me. She and Father shared a glance. Finally, she focused her gaze back on me, and she nodded curtly.
By all means, go to the hill to pray, but not for an hour. This isn't a convent. You can take 20 minutes, and you'll stay near the edge of the woods. I might call you at any time. So, Don't get too distracted with your prayer.
It was almost impossible to hide my grin as I said, I'll start tomorrow.
Mama shrugged. Maybe your prayers will be the ones that inspire God to end this nightmare. So you should get started as soon as possible. Start today.
I could not believe my luck. I was actually going to get 20 minutes alone with Tomas every day, free to talk and to embrace and to see him in the daylight. I ate the rest of my biscuit far too quickly, and then, as if things weren't wonderful enough, Mama caught my elbow as I moved to run from the house and pressed something into my hand. I looked down at it, then gasped. She'd given me a surprisingly hefty chunk of bread.
Mama, to sustain you,
she said quietly,
for your time of prayer.
There was an undertone in those last three words, but I was too excited to really let myself think about that and all of the dangers it might represent. Instead, I smiled at her as innocently as I could manage, and I packed up the breakfast dishes and then went to collect my rosary beads from my room. I made an exaggerated show of holding the beads in my open hands, just to be sure Mama saw them. Even once I left the house, I walked slowly through the field, because I wasn't sure my parents weren't watching me. I couldn't seem too eager to commence my time of prayer. I knew my story was flimsy, but it was the best I could come up with, even after racking my brain half the night. The woods were thick, a curious mixture of dark green fir branches up high and bright green birch trees nestled below. Most of the rest of the land surrounding the hill had been completely cleared for farmland. But this little patch of woods was so rocky and steep, it had been left dense and wild. I half expected to see Tomas sitting on the long flat boulder in the big clearing at the top, as he'd always done in the pre-war days. But as I neared it, I realized that was far too exposed now that he was in hiding. I almost called out to him. But then it occurred to me how foolish that idea was. If he was deep within the woods, I'd never find him. And that was the point, wasn't it? He wasn't even expecting me today. When we made this plan at night, we expected it would take me some time to convince my parents I should come. I walked just inside the thickest part of the woods and found a log to sit on. I was disappointed and dejected, but I couldn't go home so soon. Not without arousing suspicion, and I wasn't about to blow this amazing arrangement on the first day.
Alina,
a soft voice called, and I spun around, but still couldn't see him.
Tomas?
Look up, moje fistko,
he said, his voice lilting with amusement. He was sitting in the fork of a tree, far too high for my comfort, especially with his legs swinging on either side of a branch that looked barely strong enough to hold even his meager weight. He grinned, then slipped easily from the tree and walked a few steps toward me.
That is not a safe place to hide,
I protested as I rose from the log and jogged toward him. He shrugged easily and said,
Nothing is safe anymore, Alina.
He said the words as a joke, but there was a heaviness in his voice, too. I was reminded that we had so much left to talk about now that we could finally talk.
Tell me now about this trouble, I demanded.
But he hopped over a few boulders to reach me, then he wrapped his arms around me.
It is so wonderful to hold you again in the daylight,
he whispered against my hair. I pressed my face into his neck and closed my eyes, breathing him in. Soon, I lifted my face toward him and simply stared up at him in the daylight for the first time since his return. He stared right back at me, and spontaneously we shared a contented smile. Even deathly thin, even with a smear of dirt on his cheek, even with a scruffy beard and unkempt hair, he was still handsome to me. The world seemed utterly perfect in that moment. The morning light peeking through the canopy overhead, the smell of dew on the ground, the birds in the distance, and best of all, Tomas's arms around my waist.
He tucked a wayward lock of my hair behind my ear. Then he bent to kiss me gently and sweetly.
One day, I will take you away from here, he whispered. One day, we will go someplace safe, someplace peaceful. One day, when you're my wife, we will have the nicest house in the nicest street and the cutest children in the town, and everyone will say, look at Tomas and Alina, childhood sweethearts now growing old together. You're going to be one of those women who ages well. I can see it now. Even when you're an old babcia, you'll be breathtaking and I won't be able to keep my eyes or my hands off you.
You've always been such a dreamer, I sighed. But I was happily distracted. I was relieved to see a glimpse of the old Tomas, relieved that this lighter side of my love had survived whatever had kept him away from me for so long. In those disjointed nights at my window, I'd caught glimpses of a man who wore guilt and sadness like a mask. It was every bit as much a relief to see the sweeter side of him reemerge as it was to hold him close to me.
So, how did you convince your parents? He asked me.
I told them I wanted to retreat to pray the rosary, I told him, and I lifted the beads from my pocket to show him. He burst out laughing.
And your parents actually believed that you were taking meditative prayer walks in the woods? He asked me incredulously.
I giggled as I nodded, and he kissed my hair again.
You need to trust me, I scolded him gently. I can keep your secrets, Tomas.
I have no doubt about that, he said quietly. But I have a responsibility to keep you safe, above everything else. It's risky enough for us to meet just now.
Have you joined the resistance? I asked him. The Polish underground army had been chipping away at the Nazis for some time, more of an irritant to the occupying forces than a matched opponent. But Truda occasionally brought whispers of a secret newspaper and supplies shipments delayed or destroyed by organized attacks. I was scared for Tomas, but I was also proud to think he might be involved in those efforts. I had a feeling our liberation was only a matter of time if heroes like Tomas Laski were on the job.
I am fighting back the only way I know how, he whispered. Do you trust me?
I pulled away to look up at him a little incredulously. How can you even ask me that? Do you trust me?
With my life, Alina, he said.
The intensity in his gaze was breathtaking, but I wasn't distracted this time. I gave him a pointed look and said, then you must tell me everything.
I will, he promised. I will tell you every excruciating detail, just as soon as I can. But today, let's sit somewhere and pretend it's an ordinary day and the world isn't going to hell around us.
I sighed and let him take me away with chatter about this glorious post-war life we were going to share, once all of the ugliness and fighting died down. I gave him the bread, and he pocketed it, but promised to eat at least half himself. I wanted to believe him, but somehow I knew that his friends in the resistance would benefit from the spoils of Mama's generosity, much more than Tomas himself would. We kissed goodbye, and although it wasn't even 9 a.m., we said goodnight because he wouldn't risk a visit to me at the window anymore. I ran back down the field to the farmhouse, and I was surprised to find Mama weeding right at the edge of the woods, much closer to Tomas's hiding spot than I'd anticipated. She was close enough that if we'd spoken at normal volume, she'd likely have heard us. So I was suddenly very glad that we'd kept our voices at a whisper. When she saw me approaching, Mama asked me wryly,
has your soul been comforted?
Oh, yes, Mama, I called back, and I threw myself into my chores that day with gusto.
Chapter 14 Alice. When Mom arrives from the chambers that afternoon, Babcia is resting peacefully. How has she been? Mom asks me. So it turns out she can understand at least some Polish spoken words, I tell her. How much Polish do you remember? None, unfortunately, Mom says. I spoke some when I was a kid, but when Pa was studying to recertify as a doctor here, he had to learn English very quickly, and Babcia was trying to pick it up at the same time. They banned Polish in our house when I was maybe 4 or 5, so that we'd all have to use English at home, and I haven't used my Polish since. I show her the AAC message history and Babcia's notes on the iPad, and she pauses and runs her finger over one line. Alina, she reads, frowning. Do you know her? No, but... Mom's brows knit, then she looks at me thoughtfully. Remember? She wanted me to name you Alina. I look at her blankly. I didn't know that? Sure you did. I definitely didn't, Mom. Mom suddenly looks a little wistful. She said it was a family name. I grew up with an unusual name, at least unusual for here, and I didn't want that for you. Your father suggested we use an American variation, and Alice was as close as we could get. Why did she call you Julita if Alina is the family name? Well, this almost proves the point. I'm sure she told me at one point that Julita was from Pa's side, so I guess that means Alina was from Mom's side. You never told me this, Mom, I laugh softly. Mom frowns. But I must have told you, because you put your own spin on it with Pascal. I looked at her in disbelief. Mom, adjusting the name Alina to Alice is a stretch enough already. How on earth do you think Pascal relates to this? Alina, Alice. Allie, Callie, Mom says. Then she pauses and says incredulously, Are you telling me that was an accident? What other reason could you possibly have for giving your daughter a name that shortens to almost exactly the same nickname as yours? Mom, we named Callie after Blaise Pascal, just like Eddie is named for Thomas Edison. It was Wade's dream to name his kids after famous scientists, and I just so happened to like those names. I didn't even notice the nickname thing until you just pointed it out. Huh, Mom says, and we both laugh softly. I sober quickly, though, and I say, Do you think Alina was Babcia's mother? I don't even know. She just said it was a family name. Mom frowns. Then she looks at the iPad again. Ziak isn't familiar at all, though. Babcia's maiden name was Wisniewski. Next, Mom picks up the letter Babcia wrote me, and then she scans the older letter, the one we can't quite read. Finally, I show her the tiny shoe, and recognition and surprise flicker across her face. I forgot all about that shoe, she murmurs. I haven't seen that thing in decades. She picks it up and cradles it in her palm with utmost care. Was it yours? I ask her. She shrugs. I have no idea. It was probably Pa's most precious possession, other than his U.S. Medical Board registration, once that came. He kept this in a padded box in the top of his wardrobe, and when I was really young, he'd bring it out sometimes and just sit in his armchair to stare at it. Actually, I remember asking him over and over again what it was from, because he would always answer me with silly jokes. One time he told me it was a time machine. Another he said it was a portal to another world. Things like that. She laughs weakly, then sets the shoe back on the table. Maybe he got sick of me asking, because eventually he stopped bringing it out, at least when I was around. I know you've never understood this, Alice, because we tried to be open with you about everything we could right from when you were tiny. Sex, death, Santa Claus. You know how I liked to tell you the truth, as much as you could handle at every stage of your life. That approach had been uncomfortable at times, like the time I walked in on my parents at a very awkward moment, and the next morning they sat me down and talked to me in excruciating depth about love and sex and intimacy and why there was nothing shameful or embarrassing about the whole incident. Somewhat ironically, the single most embarrassing moment of my life was not so much seeing my parents' naked bodies in flagrante, but the long post-mortem the next day. That conversation aside, I've always appreciated their openness. There was never any time when I'd ask my mom about something and she'd shut the conversation down. That just wasn't how she parented. Well, you know, Pa and Babcia had a very different approach in life to all that, Mom says now. There were things we talked about when I was a kid, sure, but there were also plenty of things we did not talk about. My parents had a whole set of memories they just could not bear to face. Everything to do with the war was off limits. Mama would talk about her childhood a lot, but Pa couldn't even manage that. Mom hesitates suddenly. Then she sets the shoe down onto the tray table, and she glances at Babcha's sleeping form. Maybe it's a crazy theory, but sometimes I wondered if Pa was actually Jewish. I look at her in surprise. But he always came to Mass with us at Christmas and Easter. Yes, but the Catholic Church was definitely Mama's passion. Pa never once went without her, and even when he did go, he never took communion, and once they moved into the care home, I think Mama was taking him to a synagogue. I asked her about it a few times, even directly once, but she dismissed the question and just said they were spending some time with friends who happened to be Jewish. I mean, that retirement home has a great Jewish community, so that did make some sense. But she hesitates, then shrugs. They left Poland bang in the middle of the Holocaust, and I do remember Mama telling me they were petrified when they arrived here and realized that America wasn't the multicultural paradise they assumed it would be. Mind you, I have no idea what actually happened to them in Poland. But if Pa really was Jewish, well, you don't need to be a historian to know it would have been hell on earth. I look down at Babcia, my chest constricting as, just for a moment, I try to picture my sweet, compassionate grandparents surviving in Nazi-occupied Poland. Pa was the kind of person you only meet a few times in a lifetime. Whip-smart and determined, but also humble and generous to a fault. As for Babcia, she's tough as nails, but she's always been so optimistic and sometimes too quick to believe in the goodness of people. I can't even begin to understand the kind of resilience my grandparents must have possessed to survive that war and remain gentle in spirit the way they did. Did they ask you to take them back to Poland? I ask Mom quietly. Yes and no, Mom says. Pa was adamant he would never go back. I think that's why Mama didn't even entertain the idea until he got sick. Then she asked me right after I took the district court posting, and there was just no way I could take the vacation time. In fact, the timing could not have been worse for any of us. And frankly, I was a little annoyed she waited so long, just like I'm annoyed about this photo nonsense now. You know as well as I do, Alice. Your father and I went to Europe several times when you were a kid, long before Pa got sick. Why didn't she ask me then? I'd have gladly added a stop in Poland if all she wanted was some photos. And there's no one back there we can contact? I ask. No one at all? She used to send letters to her sister, every week for years and years. Mom glances at the iPad again, then reaches for it and unlocks it. Well, I thought it was her sister, but I remember her saying she was trying to write to Amelia. But look, she's written Amelia Slaska. I wonder if that's who she was writing to. Slaska. Slasky. Maybe it's a typo. I wonder if it was a relative on Pa's side. Did they fall out of contact? I ask, and Mom looks up at me. Oh no, Amelia or whatever her name is, never responded. Eventually, I think Babcia had to accept that she'd died. I'm sure you know Polish history about as well as I do. Even once the war ended, the country was occupied by the communists for decades, and things were still really rough there. Who knows where this sister of hers ended up, if she was even alive after the war ended. You know, I was well into adulthood before Babcia gave up with those letters. She must have said hundreds over the years. Mom pauses, then adds softly, actually, maybe it was thousands. Poor Babcia, I whisper, my throat tightening. I can't even imagine what it would be like to leave everything like that and not know what became of the people you'd left behind. We stand in silence for a long moment. Then Mom asks, so, did she understand when you told her you can't go? I swallow hard. I didn't tell her I can't go. Not yet. It's hard to say with the AAC. I need to explain to her all of the reasons why it's impossible. I'll have to think about how to word it tonight. Surely she understands this is just asking too much of you. I don't know, I say. It's too hard to explain to Mom why I'm so tempted to try to find a way through the difficulties of my home life to actually fulfill this crazy quest. Because so many of my motivations start with, when Mom was too busy working to give me what I needed, Babcia filled the gap. Who knows what's going on in her mind? She's probably confused. Mom sighs. Maybe she'll forget she even asked this tomorrow. Maybe, I agree weakly, but then I glance at the time. I have to go pick the kids up. I'll bring them by a bit later so they can see her. Fine, Mom sighs, but then her weary gaze brightens just a little. You're bringing Callie too this time? Yes, Mom. I match her sigh with my own. Callie too. I'm back at Babcia's bedside within an hour, this time with both kids in tow. Eddie climbs up to snuggle into Babcia's side. He pulls the tray table over their legs, and he tries to make the precious dreidel spin. After a few attempts, Callie gets impatient, snatches it from his hand, and sets it going. Eddie sucks in a delighted breath, then he squeals and claps his hands. Callie greets Babcia, but quickly falls into a conversation with Mom about her school day. Babcia's eyes follow me as I move around the room. I keep my body busy just to expend the frenetic energy generated by my racing thoughts. I toss out some old flowers in a vase from earlier in the week and adjust and readjust the blinds as the afternoon sunlight grows too bright. I'm vaguely aware of Babcia using the iPad, but I'm startled when it speaks for her. Alice, home now. I turn back to Babcia in surprise. She looks pointedly at me, then she turns back to the iPad. Alice, home now. Later, Alice, plain Poland.
What's she talking about?
Callie frowns. She's very ill, Mom tells her sadly. She's not making much sense at the moment, darling. You needn't worry. But Babcia is making sense to me, and it's becoming increasingly apparent that she's not going to let this drop.
Chapter 15. Alina. Each day over the next few weeks, Tomasz and I would sit in the woods holding hands or embracing, happy enough just to be together. On the very best days, he'd spin a tale for me. Usually a tale about us escaping, moving far away from the war and the occupation and the sadness and the hunger. One day, I was sitting on a log leaning up against a tree trunk and he was resting on the ground, his head on my lap as I played idly with his hair. I'd trimmed his hair and beard a few times since his return, sneaking scissors under my coat to help tidy him up. I did a woefully bad job of it, but I took an immense amount of pleasure from being able to do that one small thing for him.
Where should we go today? He asked me.
I pondered this for a moment, running through the very limited list of countries I knew about, but I settled on his favorite fantasy. America, I said.
Ah, America is a very rich country, you know. We would surely live in a mansion, Tomasz said, and a big grin covered his face as he glanced up at me.
I'd settle for a house, I sighed, because at least that day I wanted the fantasy to be a little realistic. But then I paused, thinking of my parents' tiny place, and how much larger the home Tomasz and Alexei and Emilia had once shared. House could mean so many different things, even in Poland. I couldn't fathom what homes would look like in a wealthy country like America. A big house, mind you.
Well, we'd need a big house, he agreed.
And when I looked down at him, his eyes crinkled.
For our 11 children, of course.
11? I gasped, then I laughed. This is my fantasy, Tomasz, so I get to pick the number of children we have. We'll have a small family, just 4. I paused, then added, okay, maybe 5, but certainly no more than 6.
And I'll be a doctor, of course.
Of course.
Can I be a specialist doctor in this fantasy?
A specialist? I said, then I looked at him in surprise. What kind of specialist?
A children's doctor,
he smiled. Do children have their own doctors? That seemed as unlikely as the idea of us living in a mansion.
In Warsaw, they do, Tomas told me. I am sure it would be the same in wealthy countries like America. Pediatricians, they are called.
I didn't know you wanted to do that kind of medicine. I gave him a confused smile and he drew in a sharp breath, then exhaled it slowly.
At college in Warsaw, I studied under all kinds of specialists in the hospitals. For example, at the Jewish hospital, I met a surgeon.
A look of sadness and regret crossed his face.
His name is Saul.
He inspired me so much.
He made me think that maybe there's something to that more focused path. But surgery is not for me. I like talking to people, putting them at ease. I like the idea that if we ever find a way out of Poland and I can study again, I'd dedicate my life to children.
We don't need to leave Poland for you to study again, I laughed softly. Tomas turned his gaze back to me, and sadness sparked in his gaze.
Perhaps we do.
But when the Nazis leave, the universities will reopen. You can go back to Warsaw. And trust me, Tomas, no one is going to stop me from coming with you this time.
Alina,
Tomas said abruptly, and he shifted on the ground, then sat up so that he was facing me. He reached up for my hands and held both of them between his, resting them on my lap. I could tell from the intense expression on his face that he was about to say something I didn't want to hear. I resisted an odd urge to cover my ears like a child.
Even when the war ends, we can't stay here. It will be years before the universities run as they should. And I will never be able to rebuild a life in Warsaw, or even Krakow. We will need a fresh beginning.
But I can't leave Poland, I said uneasily. I flicked my gaze toward him. My parents, even Truda and Emilia, are here. We need to stay here for Emilia.
A sudden tension had arisen between us, and I didn't like it one bit, especially when Tomas tried to deflect away from that statement with another of his silly fairy tales.
Maybe I'll build you a gingerbread house, he told me suddenly, his tone too light. Then, if you're ever hungry again, you can eat the house.
Maybe I'll build you a church, I told him. And he raised his eyebrows at the flatness of my tone.
I thought the morning prayer was just a cover for us to meet. Don't tell me you're thinking of taking vows.
He was still teasing me, but I was deadly serious now. I pulled my hands away from his and stood as I muttered,
You can't lie in a church, Tomas. If I build you a church, you'll have to tell me the truth about all of the things that I don't understand.
He fell silent then, reaching only to pick up a twig from the dirt and twirling it through his fingers. His expression was somber, his gaze distant.
I'm scared to tell you,
he admitted unevenly. Then he looked right at me. And there was such breathtaking pain in his gaze that I forgot I was angry with him and took my place on the log again, just so I could reach down and take his hand. I saw shadows in his gaze, like he was staring off into a nightmare. But then he shook himself, looked at our hands, and admitted,
I made terrible mistakes. I'm trying to undo them. So I can be a man of honor. All I want in this world is to be a man worthy of a woman like you. I'll tell you in time, I promise. But now, you do know what's at stake in this war,
even though I am sure your parents still shelter you and treat you like a child sometimes.
They do, I exclaimed in frustration. They really do. And that's why I can't bear it when you do the same.
That is not what I'm doing, he pleaded with me.
That is exactly what you are doing, I said flatly.
I could hear Mama calling me from the field, exasperation in her tone, so I disentangled myself from Tomas. But I was reluctant to leave him after the surprisingly tense conversation we'd just had. I brushed my lips against his once more.
Tomas, I said softly, tell me again about us.
A smile released the tension in his features.
We are meant to be together, he whispered, trailing his finger down the side of my face. We were made for each other, and everything else in the world will just have to figure itself out, because we are going to be together. I love you.
I love you too.
I pressed one last kiss against his lips, then forced myself to stand.
Good night, Tomas. I'll see you in the morning.
He stayed on the ground then, but he gave me a sad smile as he reluctantly released my fingers.
Every minute till then, I'll be thinking of you.
I turned to walk away from him, but then I paused and glanced back over my shoulder.
Tomas?
Yes, Alina?
It is time, my love. It is time you told me the truth about your situation.
He swallowed hard, but then he nodded.
I am strong, and our love is strong. Whatever it is you have to tell me, it will change nothing.
You can't promise me that, Moya Fistko, he whispered.
I can, I said, raising my chin. And I do. Tomorrow?
He closed his eyes as he inhaled, but then when he opened them again, he nodded, and I knew that the next time I saw him, he would tell me the truth. I just hoped I really was ready to hear it. I found Tomas sitting in the clearing the next day, out in the open for the first time since our reunion. When he saw me coming, he looked away, regret and guilt written on his face. I walked silently to sit beside him, but he didn't move to touch me.
I watch Emilia come with her new family on Sundays, he murmured absent-mindedly.
We sat for a little while, listening to the quiet sounds of the woods.
I sit in a tree near the path on Sundays just so I can watch her. She is always holding Truda's hand.
Yes, I whispered.
Mateusz is always right behind them. He scans for danger as he walks. I can tell he is a good father to her, too.
He is.
I have watched you, also, sitting on the steps with her after your lunch, he said. Then he smiled softly. I see that my sister still talks a lot.
She does.
What is the paper she always carries with her when she visits?
Drawings, I murmured. She draws for me and for Mama. Flowers, mostly.
I didn't tell him how dark those pictures had become. He seemed to have plenty to worry about without that knowledge.
They are very good. She's quite the artist.
Clever girl. She is sad. And she is scared. But she is loved, he added. Then he looked right at me. Most of the Jewish children in Chibinya are gone now, Alina.
I frowned at the abrupt shift in the direction of our conversation.
Well, yes, I know.
Most have been starved to death
or been taken to a camp or worked to death or executed.
I squinted at him, confused.
I do know this, Thomas. It is awful and it's sad, but I know.
Perhaps. But do you know what the difference is between Amelia and those Jewish children?
I struggled to find an answer to that, and in the end could only offer a somewhat helpless,
I don't know.
They are both children of God, but also children of our great country. They are both our hope and our future as a nation and as a species, and that is all that should matter.
He shifted on the rock, then rose and took my hand.
Let's walk as we talk today. I know you can't go far from the field, but I can't bring myself to look at you while I tell you this.
And so we walked in silence, off the path, along the rocky outcrops where the slope was steep. After a moment or two, he squeezed my hand and he said softly,
"If Emilia was a Jewish child in Warsaw, she would be in a ghetto today. I know food is scarce here, but the children in the ghetto have been eating sawdust and rocks to fill their empty little stomachs. Because, after a while, hunger and pain feel the same, and they just need relief. And I know people have been getting sick here, but the children in the ghetto have been dying at such a rate that the authorities can't keep up with all of the bodies. And I know that Emilia is scared here, but she still smiles. The children in the ghetto do not smile, because there are no longer any glimpses of joy in that life. There is only fear and pain and hunger. And
he drew in a shuddering breath. Then he said miserably,
"Alina, if Emilia was a Jewish child in Warsaw, she would be in that ghetto. And maybe she would be there because of me."
I stopped dead in my tracks. I had tried to prepare myself for something shameful, but I was so horrified at that statement that I couldn't hide my reaction to it.
"What?"
I croaked. I could feel the blood draining from my face. Thomas, too, looked much paler even than usual. He exhaled a heavy breath and began to rub the back of his neck. He kept glancing at me, like he was trying to figure out if there was a way to avoid honesty with me, even in that moment. Or perhaps he was sizing me up to see if I could handle the truth after all. The silence was stretching too long, and I couldn't stand another second of it. I hardened my gaze and crossed my arms over my chest.
"Explain yourself,"
I whispered fiercely. He closed his eyes and I raised my voice.
"Explain yourself, Thomas."
His eyes dulled, and then his shoulders slumped forward.
"Do you remember when I told you that I want to become a pediatrician?"
he whispered.
"Of course," I said,